The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis Podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show.
It is my great pleasure to be joined today by Dr. Nathan Fayard, an assistant professor of English at Indiana Wesleyan University. He specialises in Old English literature, medievalism and the Inklings, and he's recently authored a new book called The Recovered Images. We're going to be talking about Nathan's work, as well as sharing a paper that he presented at the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference, which was held at George Fox University in Oregon. And the title of Nathan's paper there was Prometheus on Perelandra, the Inversion of the Satanic Hero. Nathan, let's chat about Milton. For someone who is not familiar with John Milton, would you just say a little bit about who he was?
Absolutely. So Milton is one of the great English poets, and especially Renaissance poets, the early modern era. He's writing during this really crucial time between the displacing of the monarchy by Cromwell's government, and he's navigating key moments of English history. But what really matters for us is he sets out to write the great English epic, and he chooses as his subject the fall and its consequences. And so he writes Paradise Lost, this staggering, beautiful tale that Lewis and literary scholars in general see as this match, this equal to the great epics of the ancient world. And it does what Lewis is so good at, which is it helps to conceive the inconceivable, to make concrete the abstract. It helps us to imagine what an unfallen world could be like, and helps us to sort of see how this story could actually work out in a way that's accessible to us imaginatively and emotionally.
And do we know how Lewis would have first encountered Milton and what he thought of Milton and his poetry, and particularly Paradise Lost?
So I forget where he first encountered him, but he read him with joy much of his life. And he saw Milton as one of the very greatest of English poets. And Paradise Lost was one of his absolute favorite works. And it goes on to, Milton and Paradise Lost in general go on to influence his work in multiple ways, but especially in Perelandra.
Well, tell us as well, because he wrote preface to Paradise Lost.
Yes.
Would you tell us about that? Why do we know why he wrote it? What is it? How was it received? What does he talk about?
Yes. So not only is Lewis a great admirer of Milton, he also is a scholar on the subject. You know, he himself was part of that early 20th century Western scholar who was sort of doing cross era. Sorry, that's quite confusing. He was crossing the boundaries, the boxes we tend to put ourselves in. And so Lewis, the medieval scholar, was also a Renaissance scholar, and in fact denied the distinctions we tend to draw between those categories. And he writes the Preface to Paradise Lost, this book that's essentially a guide to, like, how do we understand what Milton is trying to do, and how do we approach this text to get the most out of it? And he writes it because he essentially says people are misunderstanding it, and they're coming to it with the wrong expectations. We're coming to it either from the perspective of the Romantics, which we'll get into here in a moment, or sort of expecting out of this epic poem the same kinds of pleasures we get out of reading sort of small lyrical poetry, these sort of small scale, intense moments of beauty and emotion. And we're not finding that in every passage, and so we sort of get exhausted and give up. And so he writes, okay, the beginning of the preface is, first, let's understand what this is, so we can understand how to judge it. If we're trying to judge a cathedral by the standards of a castle, we're going to misjudge it, and vice versa. So let's understand what he's doing. And so he defines epic, and he gives us some history for it. And then he sort of gives us a guide to what Milton's doing at every step.
Nathan, if you're able to do this, is it possible to just very briefly summarise Paradise Lost? Obviously, you've mentioned what it's based on, but if you could just give us a tiny, tiny précis of what is clearly a massive work, but just so that we're on the same page.
Yes. So the useful thing here is that most of us know the story it's based on. We know the basic fall narrative, the Garden of Eden and the serpent. So what Milton does is he provides sort of a grander epic context to this. And so it begins not with the garden, but with Satan just having been cast out of heaven with all his angels and sort of the beginning of his clandestine war with God. And the story is Satan's sort of getting out of hell where they've been imprisoned and then beginning his temptation of Eve. And in the same time, we're following him, we're following heaven and its reactions to these things. And we're following Adam and Eve in their unfallen state in paradise. And then over the course of the story, one of the things that Milton does is he grants what's a fairly simple story in scripture a great deal of space and a great deal of grandeur. And we eventually have Adam and Eve eat the apple, and then the story ends with them being cast out of Eden. But with the promise of what's going to come after this, what's going to come out of this, the felix culpa, the fortunate fall, that Christ will redeem them and the world will, what has been lost will be regained.
That's very helpful. Thank you so much. Nathan, would you be able to tell us a little bit about Percy Shelley? Who was he?
Yes. So Percy Shelley is one of the romantic poets, the great poets of the romantic era. So at the end of the 18th century and through roughly the first third of the 19th century, from 1790s through 1830s, and there's been oceans of ink spilled about these dates and where we actually draw the lines, I won't try and weigh into that here, but this is the Romantic era. And essentially the Industrial Revolution is going on and the Age of Reason is going on, and there's all these promises. If we can just be rational, if we can just invent our way out of our problems, we can create paradise on earth. And it hasn't really worked out all that way. And, you know, the cities are getting really corrupt and polluted and crowded. And essentially the romantics, the people who look around and say, there's gotta be more than what we're being promised or what our culture is telling us. And so they begin to look for meaning, not in reason and not in technological advancement and economic growth, but in emotion and in insight and in imagination. And these are the core elements of romanticism, sort of looking to re-enchant the world, much the same way that Lewis and Tolkien and Inklings did about a century later. Mm. And Shelley was part of that second generation of romantics in the first part of the 19th century. He was a political dissident and sort of all around troublesome guy for the powers that be. But he was a poet of great insight and great emotional capacity and great depth of connection to the people who were suffering at the bottom rungs of a ultimately corrupt society. Notably, Lewis wasn't actually that big of a fan of much of Shelley's poetry, but Shelley wrote his magnum opus, Prometheus Unbound, the story of the Titan Prometheus who steals fire from the gods, the Greek gods, and gives it to humanity, and therefore giving them power and the ability to build civilization. And then was punished for that transgression by Zeus and tortured for eternity. And you can see the parallels between that story and the Satan story and the fall story. And Lewis saw this work as in fact, the great long poem of the 19th century. This tremendously beautiful text that captured something really key about redemption and about, as he said, felicity, the regeneration of the world.
Yeah, he calls it, doesn't he, the only long poem of the highest kind that century which approaches to perfection. I mean, that is high praise indeed, especially if you didn't like the rest of his work. Yeah. Are you able to give us, again, just a very brief summary of Prometheus Unbound, perhaps some of the key characters, Prometheus, Jupiter, Asia, just so that we're aware of what you're talking about when we hear your paper?
yes, indeed. So Shelley's Prometheus Unbound picks up after that, the initial myth. So Prometheus has stolen fire, he's been punished for it, he's been chained to a rock and has vultures coming to peck out his organs. It's quite horrific in that Greek mythic way that only, you know, that mythology always is. And the story is how Prometheus becomes unbound, how he is freed. And major characters are Prometheus, the suffering titan, who Shelley sort of imagines as this avatar for humanity at large in many ways. Asia, his wife, who we sort of can see as representing the capacity for love and sort of the beauties of the natural world. And Jupiter, the king of the gods. He uses the Roman name Jupiter for Zeus. And the story, what's really surprising about it, is it's not, oh, Prometheus is this heroic figure like Milton Satan who bursts his bounds and rebels against Jupiter. No, he has this tacit rebellion in that he refuses to bow. He refuses to make peace because he believes Jupiter is wrong and a tyrant. But then sort of cosmic forces of justice, these impersonal, abstracted forces, defeat Jupiter and free Prometheus and reunite him and Asia. And the story is this sort of reverse fall, and it's this restoration of a Garden of Eden type of situation, of a paradise. And Jupiter, who is this picture of a tyrannical god, of this sort of exactly how people who view Christianity very negatively view the Judeo-Christian God as this judgmental tyrant who is selfish and who just wants all power and everything for himself. And he is dragged down to the underworld by these sort of cosmic forces that he's unleashed. And then Asia and Prometheus are reunited and the world is regenerated. And you have this celebration that's presented in an image of the great dance from the Middle Ages, which once again, is going back to the idea of the universe as this harmonious dance, this harmonious collection of movement and of shared action.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. Do we know why C.S. Lewis liked Prometheus Unbound so much? Like obviously calling it as close to perfection as a long poem can be. What are some of the reasons that he was so fond of it?
Yeah, so we actually do know several of his reasons. He writes a defense of Shelley and especially of Prometheus to T.S. Eliot, mm-hmm. who was sort of a friend and sort of
frenemy.
Frenemy, yeah, that's the perfect term for it. And Eliot was pretty down on Shelley. And so Lewis writes this defense that's like, no, here's what you're missing. And so part of it is the beauty of the verse itself. Shelley, for all of his personal foibles and for all of the ways in which he and Lewis saw the world very differently, he was a very talented poet and had a mastery of language. But also, and this is huge for Lewis, Lewis felt that in, especially that end of the story, that regeneration, that this cosmic dance, this great dance imagery of a universal order restored, of peace and justice restored, that these images did that same kind of work that Milton did. They help us to conceive that which is inconceivable. They help us to imagine paradise and, in fact, redemption of creation and ourselves in a way that is not really accessible to the rational mind. It takes something imaginative, it takes something wondrous for us to understand something that so flies in the face of the world that we know. And so that was the key piece that Lewis thought was Shelley's contribution to the world in Prometheus that made it particularly valuable.
And do we know much about Shelley and Milton's religious beliefs and how
Yes.
that would have perhaps impacted Lewis's own thoughts about God?
Absolutely. So Milton was a Christian and a bit of a rebel for his time, but from our perspective, a pretty conventional sort of Orthodox Christian. And he writes Paradise Lost, as he says in sort of the opening, to justify the ways of God to man. This is a difficult story. This is a difficult problem for us in faith. You know, why did this happen? Why did God allow evil into the world? And he sets out to try and wrestle with that question in Paradise Lost. And our mileage will vary with how effective we think he is with it, but it definitely enriches our understanding of that question and helps us to wrestle with it. Shelley is coming from a very different perspective. He's very much a religious rebel in his own time. And you have to understand, I think this is really important for understanding Shelley and for Prometheus Unbound, especially. In Shelley's era, in Shelley's age, church and state were united in power, and they were often very oppressive and very constraining. He sees these social problems and the inequality, the injustice. He sees the oppression of the British people in response to the crackdowns that happened because of the French Revolution. And he sees all of these things done in the name of God and with the blessing of the religious figures of the day. And so he's very explicitly non-Christian in his texts, oftentimes. And there's debate about what exactly that means. But in Prometheus Unbound, especially, he explicitly criticizes Christianity. And he says that the tyranny and the injustice of Jupiter, these things are reflected in what's going to happen what is happening for the worship of Christ on Earth. And he doesn't explicitly reject Christ himself. It's a bit murky there, but he is very, very critical of everything that's around Christianity and around the structures there. Oh, in terms of how that affects Lewis.
Sure, yeah.
So Lewis, he finds that same, you know, that magic in Milton that he enriches our understanding of these questions, and he definitely takes a great deal of inspiration from Milton in his own faith and in his own understanding of the world. And Shelley, he sees Shelley in the way that he sees a lot of the things that he admires, but he recognizes are out of step with his own perspective, like the science fiction that of the era that inspired him. He sees the beauty of it. He sees the things that are insights, and then he is sorrowful for where he believes it's turned aside from truth and turned aside from reality. He says at the end of that article on Shelley, it's possible that Shelley believes that there's these other paths to truth, but it's also possible that T.S. Eliot and I, there's only one path. T.S. Eliot and I believe there's only one path, and he has missed it. And that's sort of how he views it. He gets close. He gets so close, and it's so beautiful that it makes that closeness all the more tragic, but he's not quite there.
I wonder if his perspective shifted as his own theology and religious perspective shifted going from atheist to theist. Do we know anything about that?
We do a little bit. So he's reading the Romantics for the first time when he's, I want to say it's when he's at Oxford before he goes to the war. And so he's an atheist at that time. And he actually has less appreciation for Shelley at that time than he does later on as he becomes a Christian. And I think that part of this is that Lewis, as he grows and as he develops and as he regains his faith and gains perspective, especially because of his own atheism, he gains a respect and understanding of people who have a sort of similar trajectory, who he recognizes the real problems with belief and the real challenges to faith. And so Shelley, for all of his personal foibles and for the ways in which his work deviate from what Lewis believed, Lewis recognized the honest wrestling with the question that was present in Shelley.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos, and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources, and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @premierunbelievablefe, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook @premierunbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there @premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.